Hello, and welcome to In Practopia, that People, Places, Things Caribbean show. My name is Kim Zha, and I'm very glad that you're here with me this week, another exciting week of In Practopia. And I'm so happy to present our Woman Messenger series, where special women who are really doing good things with their lives and improving their communities, sharing their stories, their In Practopia in their jobs and in their pastime. And I'm just so honored. I feel so blessed to be able to do this and to be able to bring these wonderful women to you. So I hope you stick around for the entire episode and listen to what my guest Barbara Blake Hannah has to say, a Rastafarian Jamaican woman of phenomenal class. And I was just on cloud 21 talking and listening to her. So much so that my chat will be brought in two episodes this week and a continuation next week. There was just so much that we talked about that I want you to be able to absorb, digest, really enjoy and appreciate what she has to say. And I'm looking forward to all of the chatter that I know will generate just from this first half of our interview. So let's get this show started.
Oh yeah. It's about that time. Pride culture. Caribbean people. Woo. Oh yeah. In Practopia. In Practopia. In Practopia. In Practopia.
I always like to remind you that In Practopia is available for download on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. We are on the social media networks on Twitter at InPractopia, on Facebook, www.facebook.com/InPractopia, and of course our website, www.InPractopia.com, where we welcome your comments and your likes. We appreciate that so much. And now I invite you to listen to the first half of my chat with Barbara Blake Hannah, a woman of great integrity and an absolute delight to listen to. When people read about you, hear about you, speak with you, and you want them to know who you are, what do you say?
Well, first of all, I say I am mother. I am mummy. That's my favorite title of all. To be mother, to be called mother, not just by my son, but all my many children that have come to love me over the years. Mama B, Auntie B, Mommy B, they love me. My children, mother is what I am. I am a journalist. I am a writer, a person who uses words in many ways. I write for newspapers. I write for broadcast. I work for television. I make films. I'm an author. I am a Rasta. I'm very proud to be a Rasta woman. And I am a woman. I am woman. I am proud to be woman. Those are my titles. Those are the hats I wear very proudly. I always give thanks that I'm a Jamaican, that I was born in Jamaica, because it's such a special place. It's made me a very special person, a very proud person. I mean, I know the other islands of the Caribbean. I've visited quite a few, and they're all lovely. They all have their history. But somehow, being Jamaican is like that little icing on the cake that makes me really, really glad that I am born here and live here, you know, claim this as my native land.
I hope that, you know, people listening to this can take and feel good about what you're saying and also about where they're from. I was born in St. Lucia, and I think if we put all of the islands together, there is that greatness, that authenticity about us as a people that makes us special. And people around the world are seeing that. And I hope that, and through what I'm trying to do within Practopia, I really want us to be able to embrace that specialness, that authenticity, that uniqueness about us. And when we talk to one another, we can actively participate in that goodness that we have as a region and as a people.
Yes, because we survived slavery, and we survived slavery in a very positive way. We survived, you know, I mean, there's been slavery through history, but we survived one of the worst kinds of enslavement, an enslavement that was physically brutal and culturally assaulting. It replaced everything we knew with something totally alien and told us that that was better. And yet, we as a group of islands, as a people, we produced happy music. We produced color, life, liveliness, happiness. Isn't that strange? We didn't produce sorrow and gloom and doom. We produced beauty, our art, our literature, our poetry, and especially our music. You know, it's so surprising.
It really is. And I always say that. I say that I'm so glad to be West Indian, so glad to be born in the Caribbean. It's like you said, everything about us is so happy. And people see that in us, despite the terrible background that as African Caribbean people that we've suffered. And to a certain extent, I think maybe we still don't know the extent of the harshness that our ancestors went through. Because maybe there's not enough documentation, or the quality of the recording doesn't really reflect what our ancestors went through. But out of all of that, we are so happy as a people.
Mm-hmm. I think in our genes, there is always the memory of slavery. I mean, I can recall, I can sit, close my eyes and see back to some of what it was like. I can feel, I can hear the cries, I can look at a still drawing of what it was like in the sugar house, and I can see, but we have still survived. It's so strange. It's so peculiar and so wonderful. You know, I remember when I went to London to live, I went in the early 60s, and clothes were all very dull colors, mm-hmm. maroon, gray, black, mauve, dark green. And we West Indians brought color to clothing. You know, we colored it up. You know, we colored people, colored up in Britain. We still do, you know, our Notting Hill Carnival. I was there when the very first one happened, the Long Portobello Road. I live quite near there. And look at it now. It's the greatest cultural festival in Britain. And it's a melting pot festival that has all peoples involved. We, you know, despite the racism out of which it was born, you know, the racism of Britain was so cruel. And yet, look at what we gave. Look at what we've given. It's a dichotomy, but one to be proud of. You know what I mean?
And probably something that doesn't need too much investigation, and just take it as it is and learn from that. Since I've been living in America, I've come to realize that the mentality is that there has to be an explanation for everything. I don't necessarily buy into that. So maybe the Caribbean, we just need to embrace that everything is colorful and alive about Caribbean people, and just learn from that what is. So,
well, there's the God, of course. There's God, Jah, I call him.
Yes.
And we must never discount the divine in everything. Because if we believe there is an almighty creator who is the puppet master pulling all our strings, well, God had something to do with it. And it's been God's decision. Jah decided, so we are going to make it, so we're going to make them be. I will do this with these people, you know. So there's all of that to consider as well. Mm. You know, the hand of the divine in what we are, what we have become, who we are, what we have given, what we still have to give. You know.
Yes.
We are a blessed people. A blessed people.
I totally agree with that, and you just segued so nicely into Rastafari. That I want you to share your journey into Rastafari with me.
people may have a certain stereotype about it, but just reading about you, it's different. It's more pure, more holistic. So I want you to tell me about your journey into Rastafari as a religion, as a culture, as your way of life.
Yes, well, I was living in England and experiencing racism. I didn't like it. It wasn't comfortable. I'd gotten a job as a television journalist, and, you know, I'd done some of it that in England. I am a journalist, and to do it in television was no big thing. But there was so much racist reaction to seeing a black face on their daily television screen that it made it very difficult for me to keep a job, for me to stay. And while I was there grappling with that, the racism of living in Britain, two friends of mine called me and said, "Hey, Barbara, we've just made a movie. We'd like you to help us promote it. We hear you just made a film for BBC on the Cannes Film Festival. So come and see it." And this was Perry Henslow and Chris Blackwell. They just made this movie, The Harder They Come. Mm-hmm. And I went to see the film in London, and I had vaguely known about Rasta before I left, you know. My father had said, "These are good people, and always show them respect." Well, I didn't know anything about Rasta, but I saw this movie, and there was a whole culture of my country that I knew nothing about, a music that I knew very little about. I couldn't even get the beat of reggae. And I suddenly thought, wow, I'm missing out on my home country. Friends told me that Michael Manley, who was then the leader of the opposition, had just gone to Ethiopia and come back with a rod, and he was campaigning around the island using reggae groups on his bandwagon. And I just thought, it's time to go home. And I came home to Jamaica literally to become a Rasta. I thought I was going to help Michael Manley make the Rasta revolution. It turns out he didn't make a Rasta revolution at all. But I was already heading in that direction. And I just set my course to find out what it was. Because Rasta was so grounded in the Bible, that was good for me. I was a very Christian young lady. I mean, I stood up for Billy Graham when he came to Jamaica. I'd been confirmed and all of that. I was quite Christian religious, so I knew my Bible. But here were these people who knew the Bible even better. The Bible was very personal. It was a rule book they lived by, and they consulted every day and lived by the rules, as I said. And I went back to my roots. I'd been born in East Kingston, which then was a nice residential neighborhood, but by now was a little run down. But up in the hills of Warwicka was a root of Rastafari, Count Ozzy and the Mystic Revelation, up on Warwicka Hill. And those brethren there became my teachers. I would go there. I used to keep a little youth hub right on the hill. And when I finished, just for the poor youth of the neighborhood, and when I finished in the evenings, I'd go over to the yards of Count Ozzy and Dougie Mack and Sam Clayton and sit and listen to them reasoning about life. They were where they said communism. They loved Cuba because Cuba said communism, and communism, they said, was communalism from Africa. And the Germans had just chopped off a bit because they didn't live communally. But up on Warwicka Hills, they lived communally. And they taught me these principles of life. I liked the way of life. I liked the music. And I liked the rules of living. The rules of living were righteous. And righteousness was a thing to seek after. And so I did. I made it my life's journey to follow the road. Chris Blackwell offered me a job, and I didn't, you know, want to work for no record company, but he said, "I've just signed a new group and some American journalists are coming. Will you show them around?" And he asked me to go up to a house he had on Hope Road. And there I met a young man named Bob Marley. Mm-hmm. And he became my fast friend. He was an icon of Rastafari for us young people. He was a living example. We didn't know how great he would become, but he was a living example of Rastafari living. He wasn't one of those old men living in the mountains And, you know, he was just one of us. He was a young person like us. And I became part of that reggae rasta revolution. And I have grown since then. I mean, in the beginning, it was hard for me to overstand when they said Selassie is God.
Mm-hmm.
But I came to overstand that here was a man who taught us a new way of seeing Christ. Not as a white man dying on a cross, but as the resurrection of oneself, the being born again of Christhood within oneself. And that's what the emperor made us see. And Ethiopia being the oldest Christian kingdom on earth. I mean, the Acts of the Apostles chapter 8 speaks of the Ethiopian queen who travels to Jerusalem to find out what's this all about, this Christ. And on this side of the Jordan, she meets Philip. She's baptized, and she goes back to Ethiopia and establishes the first Christian church outside of Jerusalem. And that history comes right down to today with the most beautiful icons of Black Christhood. No longer is Christ and the angels white Europeans with blonde hair and blue eyes, but they're Black people like me with a history that goes back to Solomon and Sheba, to that kingdom, that whole dynasty that is still with us today. So to discover that I actually had an African history that was more than just slavery, an African history of royalty, of spiritual nobility, of righteousness, that's something I just had to cling to.
Mm-hmm.
It's just perfect. It fitted me perfectly and still does. You know, I'm a baptized member of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. Not all Rastas are. There are many mansions, and, you know, many people interpret Rastafari in their way. But for I, this is the comfortable way for I. And I've been a Rasta since, I've been trotting since 1972, which is when I came back to Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
And through my Rasta faith, I prayed for a child. And when they said it was way beyond years, Barbara, you're past 40 already, you know, you're never going to have a child again. And after praying for 9 years, I was blessed with a child at the age of 44. And not only just blessed with a child, he was born on Bob Marley's birthday, 2 months early. And the Archbishop had to come to the hospital to bless him because we thought he wouldn't live long. And the Archbishop said, no, you read the book of Isaiah, read about Hannah, prayed for a child. I said, Hannah? Same as my last name. I mean, my last name was H-A-N-N-A, but she was Hannah, the woman. Yes, she prayed for a child because she was barren. And the priest Eli said to her, all right, don't worry, you will have a child, but you must give him to the church, the priesthood. So there I had this child that I had to bring up in righteous ways.
Mm-hmm.
And Rasta showed me how to. It gave me the template of how to bring up a child in godliness, not just abandon him to the system, whatever, the so-called socialization where your child is taught to be like the other children.
Mm-hmm.
No, to be special, to be moral, to be upright, to be righteous. So Rasta has been a formula, a format for my life. A shelter, an umbrella, a home. And I'm very glad of it, very glad, you know, very glad. Each must find their own spiritual pathways, and there are many pathways to God,
yes,
by whatever name you call him or her, him and her. But this is my pathway, and it has served me well. It has served me for many years and brought me to where I'm sitting in front of you. You want to know who I am.
Yes.
You're talking to me. You know, I think, if I'd just come home and been ordinary and man, you wouldn't care. I'd be a nobody. But Rasta has given me that extra edge that makes me have something worth listening to, I think.
I love your humility, and I can just listen to you forever. And you are somebody. You've influenced a lot of people, and you've done quite a bit. I read about you being pregnant at 44 and that story to name your son. And you also homeschooled him. And when I read about that, I'm thinking that's probably not something that was prevalent in Jamaica at the time. So talk to me about that homeschooling and how he was able to achieve so much at a young age, being right there in Parliament and doing wonderful things then too.
Well, I fully intended to give him the same education as anyone else. I didn't know of any other way. But we lived in Port Antonio, and when I tried to check out the sort of little schools for little children, there were only holding pens. There was a holding pen under a church where people dumped their kids in the morning, and the kids would be left there screaming with nose knot running down their face, and two or three women vainly trying to quiet them or teach them ABCs or whatever. And yet at home, we had books. I would read him books, and his favorite book was his ABC. C was for chair, and the picture for chair was a green chair with a straw seat. And one day, he jumped out of my lap, crawled over to a chair, which is just a plain, ordinary brown chair, and held onto it, and he looked up at me with a question in his eyes. And he was saying, "Is this a chair, Mommy?" And I thought, wow, he understands. He's hairy. He's, and man, I just continued. Mm-hmm. I said, well, if nothing else, I can teach him his ABCs. And then he learned his ABCs. We made an alphabet wall. He liked trucks. So I put up a picture of a truck and two T's, the capital T and the small T. And as we drove around or read books or anything, I'd say to him, "Show me a T, show me a T, show me another T." And when he could recognize a T, we went to M for Mommy, and then D for Daddy. We didn't go ABC because his little friends in the neighborhood who would come around to play with us, when I'd say to them, "Say your ABC," they would get to LMNOP and get lost.
That's LMNOP.
LMNOP was one letter. They didn't know what it meant, but he knew what M was. He knew what P was. He knew where L was on the wall. M-N-O-P. So then we went to words. Every cartoon we watched had two words, the end, at the end. So I could teach him to recognize those two words. And after the Z is the most popular word in any book. So I'd say to him, "Show me the Z. Every Z you show me, I give you another sweet seed," or whatever, another peanut. So we would learn to read that way. Until, lo and behold, at the age of 2.5, he could read. And I said, well, let me see what happens next. We went to live in Kingston when he was about 4. And I said, let me try this school thing now. And took him to a nice school run by a very intelligent woman. But the class, none of the children could read. And the class was all about teaching them to read. So it was boring for him. I said, never mind. I had to take 2 buses to get him there, then 2 buses home. Then 2 buses to pick him up and 2 buses home. I said, forget that. We tried another school, very posh school. And they said, "Oh, Mrs. Hannah, this is so lovely. He can read. We'd love to have him. You will cut his hair, won't you?" "No, not Nazarite from birth. Why must I cut his hair?" "Well, we don't allow dreadlocks, you know." "You can keep your school then, thank you." So we continued. And then I would take him to work with me. I had a very nice lady who employed me, said, "Yes, you can bring your child." And he would do simple things, like he would turn on the computer and it was green screen dots. And Mommy had a computer, so he knew what that was. He could turn on the computer. He could find my files because he could read. And people would say, "He's so bright." They would give him books. We would go to drop off my articles, a newspaper, and people would give him PC magazine because they knew he loved computers, or they would give him, you know, storybooks. They just loved him. Books became his fountain of knowledge. He loved toys like Lego. Lego was his favorite toy. Building, pulling it apart, making something different from what was on the box. He asked for a chemistry set because he wanted to learn science. I thought, oh gosh, he's gonna blow himself up. He didn't. And you know, when he was finished, that was it with science. Books, 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 books. One day he said, "Hey, Mommy, let's make a movie." Someone had given us a week at a very nice North Coast hotel. He said, "Mom, we could make a movie about this, you know." I said, "You know," she said, "no, let's do it. He met Freddie McGregor. He said, "Let's ask Uncle Freddie to be in the movie. Let's ask Danisa to give us her hotel." And everybody loved him so much because he was so bright. They did. Mm-hmm. We made our movie. We made a second movie, the sequel. And at that point, I had to go to the minister to get my permit as a filmmaker. Mm-hmm. And when I did, the gentleman got to know him. And one day we were visiting his office. And he'd been appointed Minister of Technology. And he had his a box with a computer in the corner. And McConnell said, hey, let me see that. And he opened it up and he put it on the minister's desk and he put in all the bits and he turned it up. And the minister was just sitting there with his mouth open. He said, he knows all this. I said, yes, kids know this stuff nowadays. They're very computer literate.
Yes.
All over the world. He said, what? Let me appoint him to come and help teach your Jamaican children about computers.
Wow.
So said, so done. At the age of 13 years, he was appointed the technology consultant to the government. The news went around the world, the BBC, National Geographic, Time Magazine. Jay Leno spoke about him on his show. He became, you know, an international celebrity. We got invited all over the world. He got invited to the United Nations. And the first time he spoke, he impressed them so much, they invited him back 3 weeks later. 3 months later, he was invited to NASA Kennedy Space Center when they inaugurated a conference hall. He was invited with four tech geniuses. Those four were all American. He was the only non-American. That's been the life he lived. And, you know, at 17, he just said, well, I want to make music. We had grown up in my brother's recording studio. Mm-hmm. He knew a lot of knowledge about recording systems. And he had an instinct. He had a musical knowledge within him that he used technology to bring out.
Yeah.
That's what he does now. I mean, everyone said I was mad to homeschool him, you know. They said, you know, you're depriving your child. But now, today, there's a whole nother generation grown up of homeschoolers who followed that example. In fact, the Jamaican homeschooling movement is very strong, very mm-hmm. powerful. Because in the beginning, the Ministry of Education was very opposed to them. You know, no, you must put your child in our school. But then one by one, homeschoolers started doing greater things. It wasn't just my son who had done something great. But here was one child who graduated with 10 O-levels, who got accepted to 3 universities abroad.
Mm-hmm.
And they gradually now have accepted homeschoolers as part of the Ministry of Education. They've put the national curriculum online so you can stay home and teach your child. Or you can unschool if you want, which doesn't use a tech curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
And the school movement in Jamaica is very strong thanks to the example that I was able to set with my little son. And I'm glad of it because homeschooling allows you to control the socialization of your child. I remember once in another school we tried, I remember my son came home. We took him out after 2 weeks. He came home and he said, Mommy, I know what break time is for. Break time is where you learn to fight. I said, what? Yes. And it's true. The teachers get such a relief. They go into their teacher's room and they leave the kids to do what they call play.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the fights begin. That's where bullying happens. That's where tears happen. He said, Mommy, I know what break time is for. Break time is where you learn to fight.
Oh, wow.
I said, I don't want that. I don't want my child to grow like that. I don't want my child to be a child who has to take the bus where the girls are behaving bad, where the boys are behaving bad, where hundreds of them have to congregate at the transport center screaming at the top of their voices. I don't want that.
Yeah.
I wanted a decent, moral, well-brought-up child, as I had been in my childhood. But that hardly happens today anymore. There's no manners. In my day, if I was on the bus and there were no seats and an adult came in, I was supposed to get up. And if I didn't get up, I would be reported. That doesn't happen nowadays at all. There's none of that manners and morality. That's disappeared. And I wanted to make sure my child grew with that level of civility, with that knowledge as well. I mean, they don't teach Greek and Roman mythology in schools. They don't teach Latin, which is the root of language. If
mm-hmm.
if you know the basics of Latin, you can analyze words. They teach you algebra. What's the point of algebra to me today? I've never used algebra since I left my algebra class, but they insist on algebra. Why? I mean, if I want to do science, I could learn algebra today. I can literally learn algebra today. I don't have to learn it age 6, 7, or 8.
Mm-hmm.
All of these unnecessary lessons that they teach you on this curriculum which is designed to make you a job seeker. I didn't want my child to be a job seeker. I wanted him to create jobs. I wanted him to be able to employ people, to make great things. Like he could make things with the Lego, I wanted him to make things. That's the great genius within us. We are not, I mean, most jobs are like school. You know, you sit in rows and there's somebody giving you orders in class. And then you go into office, you sit in rows and there's somebody giving you orders. I didn't want that. And thankfully, I haven't got that. I've got a unique individual who has done great things on his own. I mean, all I do with the computer is type, but he does so many things with his computer because he learned it when computers were born. He was born when computers were born. Yeah. So that whole 21st century learning is his and should be all our children's also.
Oh boy, what can I say except I can't wait for next week. So please send in your comments. I'd love to be able to include that in next week's episode. And there's also a video, an edited version that I think you will thoroughly enjoy. It had me in kind of a sad moment. But go check it out. Enjoy that. And as always, Kim Zhe, I'll be right here next time in Practopia.